listening to By the Well, a lectionary-based podcast for preachers recorded on the land of the Wurundjeri people.
Hi, I'm Sally Douglas.
And I'm Monica Melanchthon.
And this week we're looking at the readings for Pentecost 10, which is Sunday, August 17. They're Isaiah 5, 1 to 7, Psalm 80, verses 1 to 2, and then 8 to 19, Hebrews 11, 29, right over to chapter 12, verse 2, and Luke 12, 49 to 56. Monica, can you tell us about Isaiah?
Okay. You know, the book of Isaiah is, of course, in Christian circles, is sometimes called the fifth gospel.
Yes.
Because there are so many texts within it that seem to allude to the coming of the Messiah, which is Jesus Christ, which is, of course, a Christian interpretation of the book. But having said that, a little bit about who Isaiah was, you know, and the society in which he lived. Isaiah prophesied during the 8th century, and it was a time which had undergone great socio-economic and political changes, particularly since the introduction of monarchy. And in pre-monarchic times, the tribal confederation, the times of the tribal confederation, the majority of the population was peasants, living off their land in egalitarian communities under the leadership of elders. And these tried to guarantee the welfare of everyone, especially the weaker members of society, such as the widows and the orphans and the strangers. Yahvism's Judah, which was Judah's traditional religion, permeated, inspired, and directed every aspect of people's lives. And all this changed with monarchy. And during the time of Isaiah, the economy was controlled by the ruling classes and their wealthy associates. So the result was an accumulation of wealth by the elite at the expense of the poor, ordinary citizens who were impoverished through this unjust and exploitative policies of the powerful. And the system was based on a Canaanite model of the city-state, where Baalism favored a social system in which the ruling classes controlled the economy, even if it meant oppressing the rest of the population.
And it was seen as divinely approved.
So divinely in the Canaanite city system, yes. Yeah. So it was basically, of course, this went against Yahvistic principles. But basically it was a time of implicit rejection of God's absolute sovereignty over human affairs in favor of a reliance on human resources, such as the political, economic, and military structures of the state, including foreign alliances. And so this, of course, you know, is termed as the sin of pride that was at the root of all the disorders of Israelite society that Isaiah was condemning through his prophecies of judgment, on social inequalities, injustice, and militarism. And of course, we are talking about Isaiah 1 to 39, the prophet Isaiah of Jerusalem, because Isaiah 2 and 3 are different people.
That's right. So just in case people aren't aware of that, it's commonly thought by scholars that it's not one, we're not seeing the work of one author or even focus on one prophet, but there are three books within Isaiah.
So this is with reference to approximately chapters 1 to 39, although you will see some sections that belong elsewhere.
This is
the prophet of Jerusalem, Isaiah of Jerusalem, who is speaking. And so, you know, here, chapter 5, Isaiah is, the book as a whole has some really striking passages. And we're all familiar with them. And this is one of them, and it is identified as a love song because it begins with the words, "Let me sing for my beloved, my love song." Or it's sometimes termed as the song of the vineyard, you know. So here, with love poems in ancient West Asia, a common venue for epic conjugal meetings is the vineyard.
Right.
You see this in the Song of Songs as well. So therefore, the vineyard is used, also euphemistically for a woman's sexuality in the Song of Songs, but we will not discuss that right now. So this lyrical narrative of love is between the vineyard and the one who tends to the vineyards every need. And so we are first given a sort of a laundry list of actions that the farmer has done on behalf of the vineyard.
It's quite tender too, yeah, isn't it? Yeah. I've done this work. I've dug and prepared.
He's prepared the land, cleared it of all that was unneeded, and then plants and watches the vineyard, the plant grow. And what does it bear?
Yeah.
It bears... it does not bear sweet fruit
That's
as expected,
right. Wild
but rather
grapes.
Bitter fruit or wild grapes. Yeah. So, so therefore, in what way is this a love song? Because it becomes a song of unfaithfulness.
It does.
Yeah. So the song ends with not love, but rather anger and frustration. Because the farmer is going to dismantle the vineyard, remove the hedges and allow it to be devoured, break down the walls so it can be trampled down, make it a waste, not prune or hoe it so it will be overgrown with thorns and thistles. And the farmer will command that the rain not fall upon it, you know. So, and then later on in the same text, the farmer is identified, and the farmer is none other than Yahweh, the Lord of hosts, and the vineyard is the house of Israel, and the people of Judah.
And so, it's so striking that bit, expected justice and saw bloodshed, righteousness and heard a cry. It's so clear in the text. This is about what have you done?
Yeah. And as I think I've mentioned this elsewhere perhaps, but the word cry here refers to the cry of the oppressed. It's a special word in Hebrew that is used to refer to. So it's the poor, the women, the marginalized, the widows.
Monica.
This is the cry that, you know, that is coming out of this vineyard. So this is the context of the text, you know.
I remember when I studied Isaiah being so struck by how central this theme is throughout the whole book, this cry for the justice. And it's so interesting that we seem to miss that in the church over centuries, that the centrality of God's dreamings for justice and mercy for the vulnerable and the marginalized.
So the song is first of all a commentary on us, if we are the vineyard or like Israel and Judah, you know. So it's not an indictment against one individual.
Yes.
It's a parable that is targeting all people, you know, who have been found to be unfaithful or who have not lived up to the expectations of the farmer, namely God. And so instead of responding to God's grace and mercy and interventions in its history with praise and thanks and live lives of love, these people are instead like wild grapes, bitter, sour, not doing the good that they are meant to do, particularly for the marginalized in community.
It has that sense, doesn't it, of Jewish prophecy not being about predicting the future, but rather about trying to wake the people up to what God is yearning for in the now.
But at the same time, I think it's a commentary on the farmer as well. It says something about what the farmer has done, what the farmer expects to be the outcome of his or her hard work and labor. If we are the farmers today, how would we respond to an experience like that? We put in all the work and the crop fails. So in a sense, I guess this text will speak a lot to farmers amidst us. They would know the frustration and the grief that is being expressed here by the divine. So while we are the vineyard, we are also the farmers in the sense we are co-creators with God.
Yeah.
And our vineyards, our institutions, our churches reflect our leadership and our fruits, you know. So there is a very, very sharp message for those of us in positions of pastoral care, in leadership, in decision making, that we have a responsibility, you know. I hope people are able to make the connection.
Absolutely. And I think it's when we're coming to these texts, a couple of things strike me. One is both God's active participation in that metaphor of tilling the land and preparing it, but also there is still choice. People are choosing, people still have choice about whether they respond to that cultivation or whether they ignore it. And I think that's a pretty important theme for us to continue to explore. Yeah. The other thing that can be tricky with these readings in our political context right now is because of what is happening in our global village in the Holy Land with Israel and Gaza. I think we need to be really careful that we don't read these texts as being able to be quickly retrofitted into a contemporary context. No. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think just one other short thing that I would like to say in relation to this passage is just the metaphor of vegetation. In Isaiah, it's quite popular, common. But in this particular passage as well, for those of us who are wanting to pay some attention to ecological issues, we need to pay give attention to the vegetation and how vegetation is used to depict wickedness and evilness, and also flourishing
and goodness. We just wanted to share from the World Council of Churches a recent statement that's come out, just because we know that ministers are wrestling with and lay preachers about how to address questions of Israel, particularly when the readings are coming up with this kind of text. The World Council of Churches Central Committee brought out a statement in late July talking about the Holy Land and Gaza, and I'll just read a little bit of it. And it's been adopted by the Assembly of the Uniting Church as well. "We recognise a clear distinction between the Jewish people, our siblings in faith, and the acts of the government of Israel. And we reaffirm that the World Council of Churches stands firm against any kind of racism, including anti-Semitism, anti-Arab racism, and Islamophobia. However, the unbearable suffering inflicted on the people of Gaza and the escalating violence and oppression in the West Bank and in Jerusalem compel the Global Fellowship of Churches to speak with clarity, urgency, and commitment to the principles of justice under international law and ethics." I just feel like it speaks powerfully into this reading from Isaiah.
I think, there's a lot to reflect upon. In this passage, and I hope people have fun with it.
So Psalm 80.
Another interesting psalm. It is classified as a communal lament because of the phrase "Come to save us," which is a prayer of the people who seem to be in some sort of a desperate situation, calling for help. So the word "save" is central to the psalm, and the people here are identifying themselves as sheep needing shepherding, or as subjects needing their king. So verses 8 to 11 affirm trust by recalling God's saving acts in the past. And here again you have a reference to God as farmer who takes a vine out of Egypt, clears the ground, plants it, watches it grow. And then in 12 to 15, the psalmist is saying, "And why? What happened?" I think before we proceed to look at this, to say more about the psalm, I'm always intrigued by what these lectionary creators left out. And why is it that they left out these few verses in between, which says, "Restore us, O God. O God, let your face shine that we may be saved.
How long we be angry."
And of course, there you find that there is some frustration and anger being expressed against God. And maybe that's the reason why they left
it out. Which is a shame, because I think if we took the psalm seriously in our prayer lives, we'd be so much more liberated, being able to say to God, "Where are you, God?" Because that's what they say. We can say that.
And there are crucial questions, that passage that has been left out. It's, how long will you be angry?
Monica, I agree. I think maybe part of the problem in Christian context is that we don't seriously understand that the Psalms are prayers. So it doesn't necessarily reflect God's views about the situation. It reflects what these people were feeling about the situation. And sometimes we feel that.
Of course. And what the psalm is actually teaching us is it's okay to ask those questions.
Say it out loud.
Express your anger.
Exactly.
And so in verses 8 to 11, you have this recalling of what God has done, with the image again, or the metaphor of the vine out of Egypt. And then in verses 14 to 19, the requests for help continues, plus a complaint and a curse against the enemies who have mistreated Israel. But I think the significant part of the psalm is, yes, come save us, but also these questions.
Yeah.
How much longer and why?
Yeah.
Very, very significant questions.
Absolutely.
Where the psalmist is, or the community that is praying, is unable to understand, you know, the devastation they see around them or their own experience. And I picture, again, you know, at the moment with Gaza in the minds of everyone who watches the news, I'm sure these questions are being asked day in and day out by mothers and fathers and people who have living in tents. You know, how much longer and why?
Yeah,
you know,
and to know that expressing that isn't a lack of faith;
no.
It's part of faith.
Yeah,
yeah.
But I think what is problematic about the psalm is that there is no answer.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of the it's one of the few psalms that you find that you have to live in the mystery of not knowing.
Yeah,
and so, I think we may not be in that situation, but we can still ask why is, you know, change is not happening fast
That's
enough.
That's right.
So I think the psalm speaks to us today quite powerfully.
Yeah.
Particularly in light of these questions.
And that sometimes we can stay with the questions because there isn't a quick answer.
But I think it's also important to say that despite the lack of answer, the psalmist continues to remain in faith, in relationship with God, and, you know, ends with, I will praise you continually.
Yeah.
So despite
everything.
Everything.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So we're going to have just a little look at Hebrews. Now, I know that Hebrews is, well, actually, I think some people love it and some people really don't like it. And it's interesting, it had a murky place in the canon. It wasn't always clear that it would make it into the canon. So that's an interesting thing to know. We don't know who the author is. Don't know the timing. I personally think it was written after the destruction of the temple, but others have other views. I think more scholars think probably after. It's deeply grounded in Jewish texts. Its understanding of who the God of Jesus Christ is grounded in the Old Testament, in traditions. And we see this today in this list of all these faithful people.
It's rather an eclectic list of heroes of the faith.
And has a kind of rhythmic sense about it. So there are those who are like military leaders, and there are prophets and the persecuted. It's a curious list of gathering together. I think one of my concerns in the past, and probably still now actually, about Hebrews and the use of Hebrews in Christian context is it can be very easily read as supersessionist, as though its message is about in Jesus everything about Jewish tradition is replaced, some kind of supersessionist. So I really want to underscore that I actually don't think that's what's going on in the text. It requires us to do deeper work, and it requires us to engage with the worldview of the author or the authors. William Loder is really great about this area if people want to do some more reading, Uniting Church Australian scholar. And he talks about the backdrop being the Greek philosophical world in which there was the notion, so not Jewish, not Christian, the Greek philosophical world, in which there was a notion of there being ideals in heaven, like the true, the real, and that we only ever have kind of photocopies here, to use it casual language. And so in that understanding, for these authors, and we don't have to agree with this, this is this their context, for them the argument is that everything that was before Jesus was the photocopy version of the real. So the law was in place because we couldn't have the fullness here. The temple was in place, the earthly temple was in place because the heavenly wasn't here. But that somehow in Jesus the heavenly has come to earth. The letter of the Hebrews begins with a hymn fragment, which is really similar to the hymn fragment in Colossians, where Jesus is imaged as the invisible God. So imaged as Jesus, Sophia, as the one who is from heaven, the divine one who comes to earth, and that somehow in that now the real is among us. So it's that kind of backdrop sense. And so in this list of all these faithful Jewish people, I don't think it's saying, and they're all not as good as us. It's rather it's saying they were doing all this faithful, even though it wasn't this, the fullness of time hadn't happened yet, if that makes sense. And so then I quite like the imagery at the end of this reading about the cloud of witnesses around. It's has a sense of the Olympic theatre, like the person running in and everyone crying with laughter, you know, cheering them on and with joy as they do the final lap. Now, I quite like that image, Monica, of our forebears, you know, the communion of saints cheering us on as we're struggling around for the last race. Yeah.
Thank you for that, Sally. I mean, for me, I think what this passage, which I have not done a lot of work on, Hebrews in particular, I mean, the book as a whole.
Yeah, but, yeah.
What stands out for me is the mention of all these characters from the Old Testament. And I think the author is wanting to remind people of the connections that exist between the Christian community and the past, you know, and what those individuals, you know, offer to us in terms of faith or
That's
example
right.
and so on and so forth. And I was really intrigued by the fact that, you know, the faith of Rahab is mentioned, you know, because she's a transgressive figure within the Hebrew tradition. And then the Canaanite priest, Melchizedek, you know, establishes the order of Christ. Yeah. Priesthood that you have mentioned in chapter 5, verse 6. So in a sense, there's a reference to marginal characters.
Yes.
Yeah. And outsiders.
Outsiders.
Yeah. And so for me, I think I'm encouraged by this integration of both outsiders and insiders.
And it's interesting in 1 Clement, which is a letter from the church in Rome to the church in Corinth, and there's quite a few times when Hebrews, the letter to the Hebrews and 1 Clement overlap in some ways, that they're different. It also celebrates Rahab and calls her a prophet. Mm-hmm. So I would argue that would suggest that different communities are talking about this or thinking about this. It's very interesting.
I mean, there were other women of examples he could have picked on, right? So it's interesting that he picks a Canaanite prostitute.
Yeah, yeah, fascinating.
It is fascinating. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. And so I don't know if for preachers, I don't think we talk about the communion of saints enough personally. So, I mean, to think about who are the, like, it might be lovely to invite congregations to think about who are the people of faith, whether they're from their families or whether it's from history, who they would like to imagine cheering them along, you know? Okay, Luke 12.
No.
So this is where we put down all those songs about gentle Jesus, meek and mild, because they don't really have a place here.
Nope. I mean, this Jesus is aggressive.
It's full on.
Yep.
I have come and I will cause division. Mm-hmm. And there's fire. This is, and I think people might be quite uncomfortable about this. What I love, though, is it's honest.
Yep.
So this is a leader who's saying, this is going to be costly. Mm-hmm. If you go this way with me, it's actually, there's going to be family breakdowns. Mm-hmm. It's not the leader who says, follow me and you'll become popular, or follow me and every day will be awesome, or follow me and you'll be rich. Mm-hmm. It reminds me a little bit of Mark's gospel, where Jesus talks about the costliness of following as well. Mm-hmm. And I think it's talking practically about here and now. Like, if you do this, there will be consequences.
Yeah. And I think for me, I think, Jesus, do you think I've come to bring peace? No, I've got rather division.
Yeah.
You know, and I guess Jesus is saying, you people pride yourselves on being able to predict the weather, but you can't see that, you're not able to read the signs around you.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So there's something wrong. So here is Jesus, saying that Jesus was baptized, you know, both by water and the fire, this meant cleansing the earth of all its purity, because water and fire are agents of cleansing.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I'm in my mind, I'm thinking that Jesus's work is going to mix up gender and role divisions,
yes.
overturn hierarchies, break down holiness, purity, boundaries. And so, you know,
and
everything
yeah.
that is symbolic
oh, exactly.
within the culture is going to be disrupted.
Yep.
And this disruption will have lethal consequences. You know, so it's a complete breakdown of structures, a father against son and vice versa,
Monica,
mother
yeah.
against daughter, vice versa. And so in a way, Jesus seems to be saying, why aren't you seeing what is happening
That's
around
right.
you?
And yeah. and as so there's like, I totally agree with you about those categories mm. and would add to that wealth as well, because mm. in Luke's gospel, Jesus is so clear about the wealthy giving up their wealth. Like mm-hmm. that's going to cause division in
yeah.
families.
Right.
If someone's saying, well, actually I'm going to give away the inheritance mm-hmm. that was
yeah.
going to come to you.
Yeah.
And we already see some of the division with a few weeks ago, the conversation Mary and Martha have mm-hmm. in Luke's gospel mm-hmm. about, well, who does have to do what? Yeah.
Right.
So the disruption yeah. of expectations, so, like family and societal yeah. expectations.
But I think if you look at it a little more deeply, I mm, guess mm. for me, it's also saying that all of this needs to be done.
Yeah.
This breaking down of, you know, of or this divisions need
yeah.
to be created, or
yep.
structures have to be dismantled, because deforming or deformation, mm. is that the right word? Yeah. Is an essential prerequisite to new formation.
Yeah. So yeah? being undone and
yeah,
remade.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the Hebrew Bible stresses the making or the unmaking character mm-hmm. of formation in
mm-hmm.
terms of deformation.
Mm-hmm.
So for a new society to be formed,
mm.
All existing structures need to be looked at again.
Yeah.
Evaluated and broken down, perhaps, you know, and so contributing to a fresh start.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Mm. And I think we see, at least for this author, the author of Luke Acts, their dream of that in Acts 2, when they have all given things away and they're mm. living in community. Like that's a radical break from the culture, to be mm. living with people who were strangers as though they were family, and to mm. be sharing your things mm. in common. Like mm. this is a we don't know how much it actually happened, but for the author of Luke, they present it as being really emphatic.
Yeah,
so
yeah, and what for today, I think what is important is this is what the farmer of Isaiah 5 is doing.
Yes.
You know, breaking down the walls. So the dismantling of the vineyard, depriving it of all forms of protection,
mm.
nutrients and possibilities of growth. And so in a way, he chokes it to death,
mm.
which is not very nice to hear.
No.
But so that new life will emerge. I mean, I think we can think of the bushfire season. And,
absolutely.
And the fire, yes.
Yeah, and know, indigenous fire practices.
Yeah.
So burning away what needs
yeah.
to be burned away.
So I think in a way
absolutely.
The text is what the text is calling for us to do is to break down, to choke and starve every notion,
yeah.
Attitude or tendency that might exist within each of us.
Yeah.
That contributes to the building up of walls.
That's right. That is not of God. Yeah.
Yeah. Separate, that dehumanize and subjugate.
And I think within this reading, in terms of thinking about preaching, perhaps a couple of things come to mind. One is I'd be wanting probably to just make clear this isn't permission to be awful to your family.
No.
Because you could read it that way. See,
yeah.
Jesus came, God was vision,
yeah, yeah.
so I could, you know.
Yeah.
But also I think it's an invitation to be less afraid of conflict.
Mm.
I think particularly in my observation, I'd like to hear your observation, mm. but my observation of Celtic culture in Australia is we're very nervous to have the disagreements in face-to-face.
Mm.
People might have a conversation about, I call it the car park
mm.
Assassination.
Mm.
So they talk about what happened in the meeting in the car park
mm.
and how unhappy they are, but they don't have the hard, difficult disagreement, you know, whether it's the presbytery meeting mm. or the church council or whatever
mm.
it is. So the invitation to be able to disagree well,
mm.
to try and do that. And because even though Jesus says he comes to bring division, throughout the rest of the gospel, Jesus isn't being retaliating towards people or smashing them with violence or anything. Like he's strong and clear and not polite,
yeah.
but he's not violent.
Yeah.
So how do we do that? How do
yeah.
we disagree strongly but kindly?
Yeah, we don't disagree for the sake of disagreeing.
That's right.
We disagree because whatever it is that is being discussed goes against the expectations of the gospel or
yeah.
or you know justice. You know, so all of us have sort of you know some in what you would call unnegotiable
yes. Values,
yeah. you know, and if those values are contradicted in the way we live or the structures present themselves, then it is our duty, you know, to be moved by our faith in those values to bring them to fruition somehow. And that would mean disagreeing. That would mean dismantling certain structures. And I think that is what the text is saying. Of course, it's not an easy task.
No.
It is risky.
Yeah. You might become unpopular. Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, but I think what the text is saying is transformation, whether it's of the vineyard, begins with each of us as individual, you know, as individuals. And therefore, Isaiah and this book, Luke, is leaving us with the question, what kind of fruit are we producing? Oh. Are we producing the fruits of the kingdom?
Yeah.
You know, is it righteousness or is it justice or bloodshed and oppression?
Yeah.
Are we speaking up for justice? Are we leading people to know God's love? Yeah. In the things that we do and say, and what is it that is stopping us from doing that? You know, what is hindering us?
I think
Isaiah and Luke, you know, sort of bookending these two these passages for today are very, very pertinent, raise pertinent questions.
They really do, and the call beyond niceness and politeness into fierce compassion. Thank you.
By the Well is brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College and the Uniting Church in Australia. It's produced by Adrian Jackson. Thanks for listening.